Last time, our fourth session, we had the famous Cain and Abel story, which I took in this kind of universal way that I take it as prototypical, typical of all people from the beginning, all humans to our time. Humans in society. They can either cooperate, as Cain and Abel did before the whole problem began, when one raised crops and the other one herded the flocks. Or they can be rivals and competitors, as happened when they brought their gifts of the firstlings and the first to the Lord, the first offerings. And when one succeeded and the other one didn't, the one who was unsuccessful, the unsuccessful competitor, was so angry that he finally eventually got rid of his rival. And that caused lots of problems. And how God dealt with that, especially the surprising way of putting a tattoo, a mark, on the murderer to protect him from those that would slay him, under God's protection. And how God deals justly with injustice and the results of injustice. Very interesting story. Now, today, we want to take up what I call, in the last part of chapter 4, of the genealogy, the creator's human co-creators, that humans have achievements, cultural achievements. Our life as humans in this world is not just determined by what grows in creation and by what is produced naturally, but also by what humans have created and discovered and invented. And that is part of God's creation command: be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it and have dominion over it. That is part of the whole thing. Now, this is the first time when we're beginning to have a genealogy. And very often, people go past these genealogies as if they're not important, because they are a little tough, and they think a little differently than we do. I've taught pastors in Renton, and they said it was a really good course, except for those genealogies. The trouble is that I'm so interested, especially in the numbers of the genealogies, that I perhaps say more about them than I should. I had a sabbatical a year and a half ago, and I spent 4 months in England studying numbers, and not only of the genealogies, but of the chronologies and the Old Testament and how they were used in the ancient world. I'm kind of a nut on numbers. But fortunately, you don't have to worry about that today, because there are no numbers in this genealogy. Genealogy, the second one in chapter 5, that has a lot of numbers. You know, Adam lived 130 years and begat Seth. And then after the birth of his successor Seth, then he lived 800 more years, and he was a virile old man. He begat sons and daughters, and then all the years of Adam were 930 years, and he died. Well, we can't take that up until next Monday. So fortunately, we only have a genealogies. And a genealogy for the ancient people was quite an important thing, even among some preliterate tribes today. For instance, in New Zealand, the original inhabitants, the natives, the Maori, would recite their genealogy and know it from their tribes and their clans and their families, and have to do that in order to have a status and to have even legal right as a person. And so we have a number of genealogies in the Bible. Now, the problem is that, and I won't do that right now, we'll do it a little later, if we read the verses from 17, 18, and 19 that give all the genealogies, and a few notes of what these people did, we would be confused. Most modern people are. And they say, what is this? All these names, and they're a little hard to pronounce, and it seems to be awkward, and some people have some comments about them, and other people there are no comments about them. And what's going on here? that is helped an awful lot by scholars, and I'm not the first person to have discovered this or anything, but I agree with it, is that you have to realize that what you have here is seven generations. And seven was important to them. We've seen that before. And they expected a genealogy that's going to come to its final completion will come together at seven, and then it will have three, these are triplets, Jabal, Jubal, Tubal, Cain, three descendants. Then you know that you're end of the genealogy. So you've got Adam, Cain, Enoch, and in the case of Cain and Enoch, you have their achievements. First tiller of the ground, agriculture, the first founder of the city, urban life, that sedentary life. Then nothing is told except the name of Irid, Mahuyael, Methusael, and Lamech. By the way, Methuselah will be the variant when we get into chapter 5. And he's the one who lived 969 years, almost 1,000, longer than anybody else. But this is the first version. We're doing it right. We're starting at the beginning. Then you have Lamech, and you have Jabal, Jubal, Tubal, Cain. And you know that when you come to that trifurcation at the end, it's not triplets, you know that you're at the end of the genealogy. Like Noah had Shem, Ham, and Japheth. And Terah, Abram's father, Abram, let's see who the next one was, I should know this right off the bat, but I'll read it so I don't make a mistake. Chapter 11, verse 26. Then when Terah had lived 70 years, he became father, he begat Abram, Nahor, and Haran. So you have three. And anybody reading that in their culture simply knew, now that's the end of the genealogy. So that helps us that it's not just mixed up higgledy-piggledy. It's actually a nice genealogy, the sort of thing that they expected, and I think we can understand that too. But then, even if you've got that, people say, isn't that an odd way to talk about the past, to have a genealogy?
What do you mean, the end of the genealogy? That isn't the end of those people, is it? They have descendants after that.
Well, let's call it the end of this segment. Do you see that? The segment. And you're just going to have seven. And they kind of, they were always doing these things, I suppose because of their fingers, you see that. And finally we'll have ten all together. They're going to add three more down here. And so finally you've got ten all together. And if you look in chapter 5, the one we'll take next Monday, from Adam to Noah is ten. If you look in chapter 11, after Noah, the first son born after the flood, Arpaxad to Abram, it's ten. And ten is, well, look at my fingers. It's all full, isn't it?
Well, and that's the oral tradition, so they could just sort of...
Well, and we use the decimal system, don't we? It's fingers, no finger missing. You see, that's a nice way as a mnemonic device. And so these storytellers, and there was a story about each one of them. We know the story about Cain and Abel here, you see, and that's the story we had last time. But they had many stories, these storytellers, that we don't know anything about, you see that. And they'll give us a few now about this guy, Lamech, who has two wives, and his son makes a sword, and anybody that touches him, he's going to talk about that. So the genealogy is very odd, and so modern people, if it isn't in their terms, they often simply reject it, get the idea, or at least leave it go past. But I don't think this is part of Scripture as much as any other part of Scripture. I think it has a message, and I think we ought to try to understand it on its own terms, what it meant to the Israelites at that time, and then what it might mean for us today. I think for us today it means that God has called us as humans to be co-creators together with Him, and that we have cultural achievements that we must do. So I am by no means one of those people that say it's wrong for us to have gone to the moon. Maybe we didn't use our resources correctly and should have done other things and have other priorities, I can grant that. But just in itself, that humans should explore this world and do the sort of explorations and things that we're involved in, I think this is a rather positive sort of thing. But there still remains a puzzlement in people's minds, modern people, when they have the genealogy. This is a bad way for us to talk about the past, or an inferior way that people have a prejudice against genealogies. But in the ancient world, they used genealogies and lists. This is kind of a listing, you see, of descendants, in order to get information, especially about inventors. For instance, you know, or maybe you have read in the Bible, that in 1 Kings 4, Solomon was a very wise man, and he is not only wise in the court, but he collected a list of all, like botany, of all the plants, from the cedars of Lebanon, the biggest trees they knew, to the hyssop that grows out of the wall. And they used lists and listings like that. And they used listings for the first inventors. So that's really what we have here. Now that helps us quite a bit in knowing what it is. I'd almost say it's something like, have any of you seen that TV show? It was one of the early ones, which I really liked, called Bernowski's The Ascent of Man, on all the inventions of humankind, the biological inventions, physics and chemistry and so on. It's in the library here, I noticed, and it's really a nice way to show how our life and what we do today is dependent upon many of these discoveries. And really, I think that's what this is, a primitive form, if you want to say, not in primitive in the bad sense, but an early form of Bernowski's TV series on the ascent of man and how they learn things. And it's very positive. Something that you might not be aware of because of I have to study ancient history. When we read about these stories among the non-Israelites, usually the inventions are made by gods. And then they're brought down to earth, and then humans have them. For instance, well, you know this one. The gods used to have fire, and humans didn't. In Greek mythology, then what happened? Prometheus stole the fire because he was prejudiced toward humans, and he gave it to men. Now men have fire. The Babylonians would say that, for instance, about agriculture, that the inventor of the hoe and of the plow was a god. Their god of agriculture, you see that? And he brought it down there, and therefore, in Babylon, you had many gods and many goddesses, and so the god of agriculture would have his temple. Together with that temple was all the fields where all this was grown. And it was all many gods and many goddesses. And but here you notice what the Bible is quite different. It's monotheistic. Who invents these things? Who discovers these things? Say, for instance, metal and metallurgy and the rawness in creation that we can finally then forge it and make iron and brass humans, isn't it? That's really remarkable. Well, didn't we have that already in Genesis chapter 1, that they should have dominion? And in chapter 2, that he gave them the garden to do what? To dress it and to keep it. And this is God's will. And so I think if you look at it from that angle, it will open it up. What you have to do then, and here I'm pushing it a little far, is you simply say, when it means animal husbandry, you know what that really means? It means all the cattle ranches that we've got, and not only the cattle ranches out here on the way to Ellensburg, but the I guess he sold that now, the Black Angus restaurant chain that's connected with it, and all the stocks and bonds that go into our economic system, and the whole thing connected with, to update that. Do you see what I'm getting at? And what you have in metallurgy would go, as far as I'm concerned, as far as microchips and, well, superconductors and the very farthest of what we can do in gene splicing and all the rest of that. So I think that the parameters of this, if you first say, what did it mean then to the ancient Israelites, and then what is it equivalent to us today, is quite helpful. Okay, so much on a general outline. Let me just say a little word about its meaning first. And I'm reading from just short little, I'm preparing eventually a very popular sort of thing. And this is just a manuscript here on this to make it clear, because I'm really glad to teach people like you, because it makes me say things in a way that everybody can understand, and not just only in learned and jargon-y. And I wrote this: human existence does not depend solely on the natural growth that results from the fertility of the earth, of animals and plants and humans. In the Bible, God blessed all these things, you see that? And they're fruitful and multiply. And that's God's blessing. We call that DNA today and all of that. But human existence depends on the cultural achievements that humans make. And humans' mastery and development of the world in which we live proceeds by means of discoveries, inventions, developments, new skills. We hear of the domestication of plants, and that's agriculture, and of animals, animal husbandry. We hear of the transition from nomadic life here, there, with following the herds, and they have only music that God has, the harp and the lyre, but you can't carry a piano on them when you're a nomad, and so that's why you have this music mentioned here. But today this would be all the fine arts, including grand opera and country western, everything, all the drums and all that, and sedentary life, everything that we know in urban lifestyle. And we hear of the transformation of raw oil ore into bronze, which is an alloy of what? Copper and tin, and you have even iron. And by the way, this is iron. This shows that this was not written way back there in the earliest ages, before the Iron Age, about 1400 in Turkey, when the Hittites, and about 1200 BC among the Israelites. But this was written after the Iron Age, because it refers to iron here, you see that. Perhaps formulated in the present form by someone in Jerusalem in the early monarchy, either at the time after David and Solomon, 950, or say the time of Ahab in 850. We don't know precisely, but that's perhaps what was written. But it certainly should be updated, and if you get that, I think you get at least what I'm more interested in than anything else. Well, with that, why don't we just open our Bibles to this very section, and we'll do a little differently than we've done the other time. Instead of asking you to read all these names, people are embarrassed, I'll do that, and give little comments as we do it. And when we get to other sections that are easier, I'll ask you to read again. So chapter 4, verse 17. Really, I should have, why don't we take chapter 4, verse 1 first, because that's where it really starts. Verse 1. Now Adam, or the man, knew Eve, his wife, and she conceived and bore Cain, saying, I have gotten a man with the help of the Lord. And again he bore his brother Abel. Now Abel was the keeper of sheep, but Cain was a tiller of the ground. Okay, now verse 17. Cain knew his wife. She conceived, she was pregnant. She bore Enoch. And he built a city. And he called the name of the city after the name of his son Enoch. The next ones, there's no comment of any achievement that they had. To Enoch was born Irid. To Irid was born the father of Mahuyel. The Hebrew is actually Yal-Yad, the real sexual macho man. Yal-Yad, he begat. So sometimes it's the woman, you see that, and sometimes it's the man. We've been talking gender all the time here, but I want you to notice that they have both sides. And sometimes it says it passively, was born. And so I think the Bible uses it from all, I think it's even-handed here. Anyway, then Mahuyel was the father of Methushael, and Methushael was the father of Lamech. Now Lamech took two wives. The name of the one was Ada. That means in Hebrew, painted. Some people think she's the first prostitute. And the name of the other one is Tzila. That means in Hebrew, tinkling. So she's got rings in her fingers and bells in her toes, and there's music wherever she goes. And whether her first was the oldest profession in the world, I don't know. I doubt that. If the Bible wanted to say something or say something bad about it, it would have said more. Get the idea? So let's just leave that stand and leave the jokes keep you alive to know that there have been many interpretations here. Adda bore Jabal. That's what's more important. He was the father of those that dwell in tents and have cattle. Remember I said they are nomadic. You see that? And his brother's name was Jubal. He is the father of those who play the lyre and the pipe. So it doesn't mention other instruments, but the lyre, you know, a hand-carried lyre. Why didn't they mention a drum? Well, they could have. The drum is usually mentioned in the Psalms. I heard a lecture by a very learned German scholar on, he studied African music, and it was on drums. And he, with all kinds of illustrations, showed how intricate all the various sounds and syncopations of drums, that drums practically talk. Mm-hmm. And in Africa and some of the cultures, they practically do that. And so we shouldn't look down upon these sorts, if it's just a lyre. You know, we'd like to have a symphony orchestra with all the sophistication, but we really shouldn't look down upon it. I would prefer this, as I said, to either grand opera, to all the fine arts, painting and art. And that's part of life too, isn't it? What would you do without music? Music is just part of it, part of our living. And it's a marvelous sort of thing, and it's a human invention here. It isn't some god came down and gave a lyre to certain priests and certain choir directors in a temple. It's not like that at all. Then Scylla, that's the other wife, she bore Tubal-Cain. He is the forger of all instruments of bronze and iron. And the sister of Tubal-Cain was Naamah. All that means Naaman is beautiful. She's handsome. So it's kind of nice. Now the old theologians, and I shouldn't jump on them, and I'm not trying to hit a dead horse, not at all, because I love Martin Luther. But Martin Luther and all the rest of the old theologians, they said, see, these people from this genealogy, they're all unbelievers. Cain and all the rest, they really badmouth them. And they say that those in chapter 5, those were all believers. And that then, toward the end, when the sons of the sons of the gods, we'll have that story next Tuesday, saw the daughters of men that they were fair, and the sons of gods are the believers in chapter 5. And the daughters of men are the unbelievers. I don't know why the women get that bad interpretation. I don't agree with that at all. And basically Martin Luther's theology wouldn't have that either, but that's kind of the way they expressed themselves. They were really kind of male chauvinists in those days, and nobody blew the whistle on them. And so they could kind of do it that way. But I think that what you have here is simply a statement that this is the genealogy, and they brought these wonderful inventions that we still know today, and that happened way back before the flood. We're not told when, there's no timeline here, it's just there. Now comes the important part, and it's in poetry, ladies and gentlemen. Does your translation, if you have the RSV, it does that. And that means that you got not, like we have, a beat and rhythm and rhyme, 30 days has September, April, June, and November, but you have one line and then a thought line rhymes with it, a thought rhyme rather than what, a sound and a beat rhyme. So here, notice what it says. The first line is what? Adda and Scylla, hear my voice. And then it repeats it. You wise of Lamech, hearken to what I said. You see that? That's the way you have Hebrew poetry. We have that in the Psalms, isn't it? You have one line and then another line. Either says the same thing or contrast to it. You can have either. I have slain a young man for wounding me, a young man for striking me. So he's boasting that he's done what? Someone was his rival and contested? Maybe his rival in love. And what did he do? He killed him. He responded to that threat with lethal. And now comes the real shocker. Verse 24. If Cain is avenged sevenfold, in other words, if God is going to be the protege of Cain and protect him from anybody who touches him sevenfold, truly Lamech, 70 and sevenfold. What does that mean? 70 and sevenfold.
Well, he has ultimate protection, doesn't he?
Ultimate, yes. Mm-hmm. In other words, and you know what? Sunday's gospel is going to have that. That we're to forgive what?
70.
Yes, 70 times sevenfold. So that's oodles and oodles and oodles and oodles the utmost possibilities to see that. That what it's really is saying here is what? I don't believe that that's so important to worry about what Yahweh's going to do if somebody touches Cain. I've got my might and my strength, maybe even a sword that his son had made, which some people call this a sword song. And might is right, and anybody touches me, I'll kill him. So, what is the invention of of iron and swords done here? Yes, it's aggression. So, maybe in a world of violence and aggression, we need policemen and soldiers, and maybe they have a gun or a sword. But sometimes you can use a sword and a gun for what? Aggression. In other words, you can take, to use Isaiah, you can take the plowshares and the pruning hooks and melt them down with metallurgy to make what out of them? Swords. You can kill it. But can you do the opposite? Can you take, Isaiah talks about that, the swords and make pruning hooks? And by the way,
a lot of that kind of talk after World War One, we're going to have it was a world to end all a war to end all wars.
Yes.
We thought we were going to have peace.
Yes. And it still is the vision that the prophet gives for us for our future. The future will be that there will be justice on earth, and it hasn't come yet.
Jesus
and mostly
said,
because we've been.
There shall be wars and rumors of wars.
Yes, but at the same time, justice will also be established. In other words, we're looking for the Messianic age. You know, the final age.
Good hope.
Yeah, we're in hope. But I think, I don't know, we may disagree on that, but my impression is that since the Messiah has already, in a sense, come in Jesus, that we already now have the possibility of doing it.
Through Jesus.
And therefore, we don't have to use our metallurgy and all this for what? For destruction. And this is our big problem. How much are we going to have for military expense? So you see, these are not only, that's why I call these prototypical stories. They're not only typical of events way back when, but they raise the same problems that we are here talking about in modern. In other words, when you vote for your congressman, what are you voting for? When you speak about this, when you act, we really, it's up to us. And I kind of think this is marvelous, that the Bible doesn't only, on the one hand, it's positive. It's good to have these inventions, isn't it? Nothing wrong with metallurgy. But at the same time, they can be misused. You see that? I think that's even-handed. Now, some people used to be the hippie generation. I lived in Chicago during the 60s, so you have to forgive me. And they all wanted to go back to nature. Remember the hippies and the yuppies and all the rest of them. And they didn't want to have anything to do with any modern development, technology, or anything like that. We live in a technological age. We're up to our neck. And we're going to have to deal with it, you see that? Whether we like it or not. And I don't think it's necessary to say that we should all go back to a kind of an agricultural life. I don't think that's very realistic. Not very realistic for us. Even Holden, even though it's way out isolated here, it's very much dependent upon the outside too. Live here a little while, we realize that. No question about that. Well, I'm going to stop there for a moment. Any questions that you'd like to ask about this so far? We still have a way to go before we get to the end of the chapter.
On 17, and she conceived and bore Enoch, and he built a city and called the name of the city after the name of his son. Enoch was Cain's son, and it was Enoch that built the city, and then he had a son, Enoch.
The city.
Cain
after
named the
name
city
of his son,
after his
Enoch.
Son.
Yeah.
Well, I was just wondering about that he, if that was referring to Cain or to Enoch. I was a little confused about who actually built the city.
Yes. I think it's Cain. Do you see that?
Oh. Although,
it's certainly at the time of Enoch. You see that?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. The old theologians, and they did this entirely, you know, they interpreted all of the Bible, not so much the way I'm doing it culturally, but they interpreted it merely from a faith angle. They simply said, see what Cain did when he went out to the east, far from the way from God? He didn't trust God's own mark on him. He had to build a fortified city, and he trusted the fortifications of his city than more than God. So he's getting bad, and things are getting worse and worse and worse. Do you see that?
Yes.
And I don't know whether I would go along with that. Please don't misunderstand me that I think that my interpretations are the only ones that are possible. I think the other ones are possible. And for every one that there's an alternative, if you had a different teacher sitting here, might easily choose other combinations. But I have to be honest, with the ones that I think are more legitimate. Okay, any other comments? Let's go on.
Another question.
Yes,
you said I keep being confused by that one remark. You said that was the end of this genealogy. I know there are other genealogies in the Bible. Does it ever come back to this point and pick it up from there and make all of the generations successive?
That's very good. Chapter 5 does it all the way through. And then it will go all the way to Noah. Do you see that? And it will have a little different, and it will actually, if we compare that, we don't have to do that now, it will put two different, but otherwise it will go pretty well all the way through. You see that?
Okay.
Let me just read it so that you understand it. I just have it. Adam, Seth, Enosh. So the same things that you have down here. Then Kenan, which is the same as Kenan. Then Mahalalel, then Jared, and then Enoch, then Methuselah, and then Lamech. So it's the same names, but they're variations. Whether they're the same people, I don't know. But that's chapter 5. But I think rather than trying to do what you're trying to do is to harmonize the two, I think just take this one by itself with its meaning. When we get to chapter 5, take that one by itself. And then if we want to talk about the interrelationship, one has one message, the other one has another message. They're certainly related in their names, like Methuselah and Methuselah are very close. Lamech is the same, you see that. Irid is the same as Jared. And that one is just from a little different perception. Actually, I think it's more from what the priests formulated, you see. We talked about a formulation in Jerusalem, by the people in Jerusalem. I think that the priests were interested in numbers, and they gave us this whole list of numbers, which list of numbers eventually leads up to, I think, the cosmic Sabbath. The Sabbath when all of history will be fulfilled. That's what I think the numbers, that's, you know, as a person that's investigated that, and I'll explain that in detail with the numbers, but I have to wait till next time to take up those numbers. You see that? Here you just have the names and they're finding it. Now, what you raised is also important, that we're surprised after this section that we've had, that in the next part, we have I call it an appendix. And you start over with Adam and Seth and Enosh. And people wonder, why is this? Some people call this the genealogy of Seth. You ask in your first question, are there two genealogies? There are three. There's this one, and then there's this one, which only gets this far, maybe originally it went all the way to Noah, but it only gets this far and then the chapter ends. And then the third one would be chapter 5, see? Does that... Now, your question is a really good one. Because it asks, why would we start over here again? Well, let's read it and then maybe we'll understand it a little better. It's not quite simple. Adam knew his wife again, and she bore a son and called his name Seth. For she said, God has appointed for me another child instead of Abel, for Cain slew him. The word Seth means substitute. Mm-hmm. So we don't have a genealogy of Abel because he's out of the way and doesn't have a son that continues, you see that? But we have Seth, and isn't he's important. Then to Seth a son was born, and he called his name Enosh, which is the same word as human, usually weak human. And at that time, here comes, I think, the climax of everything we've had. Men began to call upon the name of the Lord. So what is the achievement that you have here mentioned at the time of Enosh? I put it down here, religion, calling on God. Now, this should really surprise you. If it doesn't, you haven't caught on. our religion, the Judeo-Christian religion, is a religion of revelation, where God has revealed himself. By the way, when did God reveal himself with his name Yahweh? With his personal name. He had other titles before that. God, El Shaddai, the mighty God, El Elyon, the everlasting God. Abram used such titles, and Isaac and Jacob, the God of Abram, the God of Jacob. But at what point, see, my name is Ralph. That's my personal name. When did we get to know God's personal name, Yahweh?
You're thinking of the burning bush.
The burning bush. Mm-hmm. And last, the Old Testament's lesson, two Sundays ago, was you knew my name as El Shaddai before, everlasting God, but now you're going to know my real name, Yahweh. Now, I'm not trying to be fancy here and pull rank, but that's how it's written in Hebrew. You've perhaps seen it, haven't you? That is a J or Y sound, same, phonetically the same thing. That's an H. You see it's backwards. And that's a W, and that's another H. If you put the vowels in here, you have what?
Yahweh.
Yahweh. Mm-hmm. And we translate it in English with the word, now, Lord, in large and small capitals. Not this. It's one large capital and the rest small. But this is all capitals. Isn't that the way it is in the King James Bible? That's how we translate. The reason we translate it that way is because that's what the Jews did. You could never pronounce that name, Yahweh. Don't you ever pronounce that in the presence of an Orthodox Jew, or they'll be very angry. Because you're not supposed to use the real name of God, because this commandment says, thou shalt not take the name of the Lord thy God in vain, unless they even come close to it. What do they say when that really word says Yahweh? And they know that too, but they can't say it. they always say Adonai, which is the Hebrew word for Lord. And that's why we do it, you see that? That's the name. Now, what this passage says here...
Did I understand you right? The Jews will not say the name Yahweh?
That's right. Uh-huh. Well, let me give you an example from the New Testament. You all know it. That at the time of Jesus, the only person who could ever speak out loud the sacred name of God was the high priest. Mm-hmm. And he could do it only once a year on the great day of atonement, Yom Kippur. And when he did it, the rabbi said you could hear it, even though he said it in Jerusalem, from Dan to Beersheba, from the north to the south, and from the sea to the desert, all over. And it knocked everybody apart. That's why Jesus used it once. This is in John, in chapter 19, when in the Garden of Gethsemane, They're going to take him captive. And they ask, that word I am is so important. You see, I am that I am. That's what it really means. That's what it, at the burning bush God said it does. They said, whom, Jesus says, whom seek ye? And then they say, Jesus of Nazareth. And he said, ego I me. And they are knocked to the ground, isn't it? Because he has used what? The sacred name of God. And they understood that in that culture. It wasn't just magic, you see that? It's the name of God. And I think that's why, you know, some people think the Bible's a little kooky. Most of the time when it's kooky, or it seems kooky to us, we don't understand the customs that they had. And that they, and then you see, well, Peter takes a sword, you know, and wants to cut off the ear, and Jesus said, don't do that. But see that, if you want the meaning, you see, Moses, when he had that, he didn't want to lead the people out. And he said, look, if I go there, they'll throw me out, Pharaoh, and I ask to lead the people out. You have to tell me the meaning of your name, see? Because you have to know the name of that God. Because there are all kinds of gods, you see that. And then he says, what does that mean? I am that I am. He explains it. In Hebrew, it's Eyah Asher Eyah. It's like Yahweh. You see that? It's a pun. I am that I am. Well, it could mean two things. Don't you try to use my name for magic. And don't try to fence me in. I'm God. I'm going to be what I want to be, and I'm going to do what I want to do. And I am that I am. I exist, and I'm going to do it all the way through. So, to get the background of this, this is the sacred name of God. Now, what this is surprising to me is, I wasn't right when I said, then began men to call on the name of God. They, it says, then began men to call on. Whom were they really calling upon, even though they didn't know him? Wow, that means when the Egyptians and the Babylonians and Mesopotamians and other people called on whatever God they knew in their religion, did it just disappear in thin air and the true God never heard it? Or were they calling on really the true God in their religion?
They must have been calling on the real God.
They must
have. Not knowing it. And that's a wonderful thing that happened in the Eastern cultures and their religions. They've been real miracles. And the only way I can explain it is that our God was so good that he blessed their sincerity. And
yes, I think you're right in the sense that there is something, the Bible is not always negative against non-Christian, or in this case, non-Israelite religions. It didn't just go into thin air, and all other religions aren't just from the devil. You see that? The natural knowledge of God comes from the knowledge of the true God, not from necessarily from the false God. They don't know him as we know him through the revelation in the Old Testament or in the revelation of Christ, but they know God. So when they, in their religion, are calling upon him. Let me give you this example. You all know that when St. Paul came to Athens, this is in Acts chapter 17, that he came, and what did he see there? There was all kinds of worship. They had all kinds of gods and goddesses.
They have known God.
Precisely, and there was one, and he said, you know, that God that you don't know, who is really the true creator, it's not Zeus or the rest of the 12 Olympian gods that they had in Greece, he's the one whom I'm going to tell you about. And then at the end of that he said, now your times of ignorance in the past he's winked at, but now he means business because he's brought one whom he has raised from the dead to bring history to its climax. Don't you remember that? Mm-hmm. That's what St. Paul said. And then here's what he says. Some people don't like this in the Testament, but it's there. Him whom you worship in ignorance. When you have your Greek and Roman gods, and you worship this unknown God, and you don't really know who he is, him I declare unto you. So it's just what you were saying, that in worshiping their other gods behind it, they were really worshiping the true God. Now, let me just one more question, a comment here. Martin Luther had this marvelous thing. I can quote it, and I'll quote it because I first read it in Latin. In one of his commentaries, he says, Moabitai, the Moabites, when they worshiped their god Chemosh, that was the name of their god, in Kaloheran Verum Deum, they were worshiping the true God, falso culto, with a false worship. They didn't understand him the way he should be understood. So from a Christian viewpoint, there's no doubt about it. For us, there's only one name under heaven by which we must be saved. But what about people who are outside of Christianity? Does that mean that they're going to be damned?
No.
No. See, that's my problem that I have. I teach students, undergraduate students, and they're good. Don't misunderstand. I'm not Christian. But they either want to save everybody that's a non-Christian, or they want to damn them. they want to say one way or the other. And I think that's premature. History is not over with, not even the history of, since the coming of the Messiah.
Well, and just looking in Exodus, when the Israelites as slaves called to, they didn't call to Yahweh. They just were crying out, and God was the one who answered.
Yes, correct.
So mm-hmm. they don't.
Yes,
they don't even
it,
know
it's
Yahweh.
The God of their fathers, isn't it? Mm-hmm. And then the Bible says, when they were in before the Exodus, that God remembered His covenant with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and there. The name, the title that they used for God was the God of the fathers, you see, that of their forefathers, of Abram, Isaac, and Jacob, or El Shaddai, and they had those titles. But the real name really came with that covenant, Yahweh. And so that's kind of important for us to know the titles of God. But I think that what this does say here, see if our time is running out again, is that in order to sing the song of knowing the true God, or sing, we'd say sing the song of Jesus, you don't just have to badmouth what? Other religions. I think I must be a witness. It would be wrong for me to deny my faith. And I think eventually on Judgment Day, they will see who He really is. That the Messiah, even Jews, is the Jesus, the one who was crucified. But how, on Judgment Day, how's it going to happen? When does salvation... when does He come, come, ye blessed of my Father, inherit the kingdom? After what judgment? Not that you were a card-carrying Lutheran and were Orthodox. And I like to be Orthodox. I don't think there's other way to be religious except Orthodox.
The Bible apparently gives several different answers to that.
Oh, no, no. He gives us, in Matthew 25, He says what? When I saw you, when you were doing what? Helping the poor, and visiting those in prison, and helping those who were thirsty and those who were hungry. And so atheists, you don't have to agree with me, may well go through that judgment better than people who haven't taken their own religion seriously. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean that I have the right to be an atheist. With my conviction, that would be denying my faith.
You've been given more, it makes us more responsible. More
yes.
Responsibility.
Yes. Those to whom much is given, to whom there much be required. And so therefore, I think it's premature to do like my students like to do. I mean, thank goodness they have a lot more sense than that. But they like to do one or the other, you see that? And they get into each other's hair every once in a while about that. One guy will stop dating the other one because of it. They do all kinds of things. Some are creationists and some evolutionists, and that's broke up because of that. And they kind of tell me a lot of things as a teacher. But and that's important. I'm not trying to badmouth them, but I think that we have opportunities to witness. And the witness should be a witness job, just, you know, something theoretically. And I'm important.
You don't have to buttonhole somebody and preach at them. There's chances. Every time you talk to anybody, almost.
Sure, you do. And even if you don't happen to witness and formulate it your whole life by what you're doing with your life, and by that people realize there's a secret to that life.
Well, but once you're made aware, or once you know, like the atheist has made a conscious decision, because they know You know they can follow the way of Christ. They know they can choose not to, and they don't believe that he has the power, or whatever, but they make a choice. Well, once you make a choice, then you know you have made a choice between two knowns.
Yes.
And then aren't you denying?
Yes.
So then you're responsible.
Yeah, and you're responsible.
And the Greeks, as soon as Paul pointed out who the unknown God was, at that point, weren't they then responsible to make a choice, and then they were liable?
Sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, but
I just don't think you can say.
That's right. And once they're made, but I think even there, you have to be a little careful. You remember that some of the people said, well, we'll listen to you again. Mm-hmm. And other people did listen, and there was a little cell in Athens, and they kept on understanding who he was. That takes a while to understand it. You see that?
Mm-hmm.
It's like when my students deal with Jews. Sometimes they say, well, they know who Jesus was, but they reject him. In many cases, all they know is that the followers of Jesus have been persecuting them mercilessly. And they haven't heard the gospel from us. They've heard anything but the gospel. So how could they know?
They think they know, but they really don't know.
That's precisely. Why the judgment, who's going to be the judge on Judgment Day? The Savior, isn't it? And that's Jesus. So what we have in our biblical tradition makes sense. You see that? And we don't have to be judges. In fact, I think we have plenty to do to keep our own house clean and to do what we have.